Pod. 22 Pod. In the city that sounds nice.
Huh. Finally got you on here, Fred.
I know, it's an honour
for weeks.
It's an honour to be on.
You've been begging me for weeks, Harry.
Well, at the beginning, it was about 14 episodes about the Paddington, so I had to wait for those.
That's a special number five, yeah.
Yeah, no, we still haven't finished that.
Tom Fred was just saying that you used to think he was a bit of a cunt back in the day, apparently.
Yeah, I used to wait him to come in.
I was saying the same about you.
I was thinking about this yesterday. I was like, did we ever even really hang out back then? We used to like bump into each other, like certain places and shit, didn't we? But we were, I don't know. Couldn't really remember.
Yeah, I don't think we were like close mates. I always remember thinking Josh was the nice one.
Wow.
Yeah. How wrong were you?
We started, by the way.
It's fine.
Yeah. So just for a bit of context, Fred, if we go right back to the start.
Mm-hmm.
This gives an idea of like what you're doing back in the noughties, like with your band Les Incompetents. Is that a Home Alone quote? Is that referencing?
Yeah, that was a Home Alone quote.
Right.
You're what the French call Les Incompetents. Quite inspired. We had about 10 band names before that. Used to like get the Metro or Evening Standard on the way to school, look down band listings, and then tell our friends that we were in the band, that we just seen a name on the thing to make them think we had gigs and stuff. So started life like most bands as a fictional band.
Right.
You were two frontmen as well, weren't you? Who was the other guy?
Yeah, too many. Billy Bell, the other singer. Well, yeah, it's one thing having two frontmen when, you know, like one plays bass, one plays guitar. It's another thing having two frontmen when you both just sing.
Yeah, right.
So there were six people, two singers, but that was the nature of kind of, it was one of those things, as I'm sure lots of other people have said, once all the bands started coming out and everyone wanted to be in a band, you kind of didn't think it through too much, who played what. You were just like, oh, who wants to be in a band together that isn't already in a band? And you just kind of take anyone doing anything. Like, I remember we were at school, must have been 2002, 2003, because up until The Strokes came out, I'd been listening to absolute shit, stuff like Top Loader, probably. CDs I bought, Onkers Big Mocha.
I remember saying that on mine. I was like, honestly, like some of the shit I was listening to, like the back end of the 90s was just actually mad.
Yeah.
That's a new one. I actually forgot.
Yeah, that's low. I think they're on like when they mixed with Jamie Oliver.
I can imagine that.
And Jamie Oliver was a drummer in a band at the time. I think that was the kind of thing I thought was cool because I never got into Oasis. I was playing like Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering end of the
night. This was going to be one of my questions to you because I actually don't know like who was like your obsession, like coming into that band, do you know what I mean, like as like a teenager?
Well, that's the thing. I was like, up and once they re-released Star Wars in 97 to 2001, I was just like the biggest nerd, not in a bad way, it's probably the happiest days of my life, into just like Star Wars, Pokemon, which I was probably too old for at the time, you know, all that stuff. And it was literally I only had a passing interest in quite shit music and The Strokes. It's a cliche, but Alex Turner obviously summed it up very well in the opening track of their last album. I just wanted to be one of The Strokes. It was one of those things. The second, I don't even know if I'd heard them. I just saw them and it changed the whole thing. I looked at all my clothes, like, what am I going to, can't wear these anymore. Like looking in the mirror and I was quite like spotty, like shit hair, you know, nothing's really changed, but just thinking like, how do we make our lives more like these people's lives? These five, probably like the five best looking people I'd ever seen. And I think the first issue of NME I got, maybe, I don't know if it was 2001, 2002, might be when the Vines were on the cover. So I'd got into this, my friend had a copy of the Face magazine that the Strokes were on the cover of, and we just kind of like passed that back and forth like it was a porn magazine, just like to stare at these pictures, because it was early days of the internet, so you were needing to see stuff in magazines. And then got into the NME at that time, where it was all bands that began with the, and I think my parents had got cable for the first time, so I'd got MTV2. We got that and started coming home and watching Gonzo with Zane Lowe instead of Neighbours when he was still on XFM as well. And then it was just like getting into any band with the in. I would buy albums from bands I'd heard one song, like the Datsuns or something.
Yeah.
And looking back, it was kind of shit. The music was kind of shit, but I would just, you'd hear one song that's all right, and you're like, yeah, this is great.
Anything. Yeah.
And obviously then that first Libertines cover with them in front of the Union Jack. After I missed the Strokes the first time they're in the UK. I think I didn't get to see them till when they played Alexandra Palace, 2003, I would guess.
Yeah, I think so.
And that was like our Woodstock kind of thing. That and when the Coral played the night they put on in Liverpool called Midsummer Night's Scream. And it was them. It was meant to be Kings of Leon, but they didn't end up playing like the Zootons, the Bandits, the Thrills. I think Libertines maybe played, and that was one of the first times they played without Pete. It was that kind of era of just all that stuff. So my friend who I started the band with, Chris, who was later Inspector, he basically convinced us, because we spent half the time trying and failing to get into gigs. All the gigs we wanted to see by the time they came around had sold out. So like Libertines at 100 Club, I remember they played, or you know, Interpol, those kind of, by the time we found out about the gigs, they were long sold out. And he was like, you know, if we start a band and we get on the bill, then we can go to the gig, which was quite the kind of naive idea you can only have when you're a teenager. So we were trying to put a band together, and one of the first venues we knew about that just had loads of bands on the bill was the Rhythm Factory in Whitechapel. Obviously, Tom, you played there.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah.
And we were just like, right. I think the only song we knew how to play at that time was Hotel Yorba by the White Stripes. So it was just like C and G, and I'm guessing D, but it could be F. The guitarist with me. And so we just learned songs. We had like a few songs, and then songs that we tried to play like on the same chords that I don't even know what they sounded like, probably like Lonnie Donegan or something. And we went to the Rhythm Factory after school. He lived in Dalston, so he lived closer. I lived in West London, so it was a bit of a trek. And we were like, oh, can we get a gig player here, please? We're in a band. We might still be in our school uniform. And they were like, yeah, you need a demo. And we were like, oh, yeah. I don't think we even knew what a demo was at the time. We were like, a demo, like a flyer with information about ourselves. And they're like, songs, like a CD. And I don't think any, like, I think that was in the early days of like CD burning, but we definitely didn't have any way to record a CD, or at least we didn't know how, because we didn't know anything about any of that. So we were like, okay, we need to go and record some songs. So we wrote some songs and then borrowed a 4-track tape recorder. And I remember on like one of a school off day, I don't know if it was a holiday or something, we got off Chris's friend who was a drummer. We asked if we could borrow his drum kit, walked it round piece by piece to his mum's kitchen, Chris's mum's kitchen, but the parents were out, and we were like, oh shit, we need to make this demo before they get home. At the time, we were like, they'll kill us if they find out what they're doing. Years later, I spoke to the mum about it, and she's like, I wouldn't have cared less. I would have thought it was quite nice. But we were like, right, we've got to get this demo done. Set up in a kitchen, recorded probably what I imagine, luckily it no longer exists, but some atrocious demo onto a cassette tape right off the 4-track. So then we went back to the Rhythm Factory with this cassette tape, which was the only one. We hadn't even made a copy because we didn't think to do where you put two tapes in a tape recorder. Went back to the Rhythm Factory. I think it's a guy, Johnny Rhythm. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
So God rest his soul. I think he's no longer with
us. Yeah, that's true.
And a guy, Mark Hamilton, who's in that band Senseless Things in the 90s.
Yeah, they were good then.
Yeah, and they were basically, went back with the tape. I'm like, oh, here's our demo, a couple of weeks later. And then just pestered them. Think about a month later, trying to get through to them on the phone. The guy finally remembered who we were and admitted that he'd lost the tape. And he felt so bad. He was like, okay, I'll put you first on a bill. And it's probably lucky he never heard the tape because he definitely wouldn't have given us a gig.
That plan of supporting bands you're into, sounds like it ended up working. I saw a list of bands like Baby Shambles, Mystery Jets, 80s Matchbox. How quickly did he kind of build a bit of a reputation?
I think it was over a couple of years. I don't think we had a very good reputation from anyone who saw us at the beginning. But this was like maybe pre-MySpace or early days of MySpace. I was still on Friendster at the time, if anyone remembers that, like trying to message people age 16. And I met a guy at a gig who I still know to this day, this guy Milo, you know him, Tom, who said he was managing this band Ludes and I should come and see them at that venue, Cargo. And I went to that and they were supporting someone. And that was one of the first bands in London who were kind of small enough to be able to get into the gigs rather than not having a ticket or whatever. But I saw and was like, yeah, this is what we want to do. It's quite like ska, quite, I don't know, maybe a bit of reggae, all the kind of things, music we had absolutely no business making whatsoever. But seeing a band like Ludes, he was just a great front man.
Yeah, is that Dave?
Dave Ashby.
Dave Ashby's first band, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
They were actually really good.
Yeah, he'd be a good one to get on, actually. Because the guitarist ended up being the early Machine in Florence and the Machine as well, Matt.
Yeah, Matt.
And he played with Skaters for a bit.
Mm.
So that's another Paddington's connection. So I'd seen them at Cargo and then went to see them again and Mystery Jet supported. And so it was just like seeing bands and then literally going up and harassing them after. Remember the first time I saw Mystery Jets, I was like, okay, this is definitely like nothing I've ever seen. Someone's dad's on the stage. I don't think I'd ever even talked to my dad about music, let alone suggested we jam together. I was like, wow, it just felt like, you know, if someone's dad can do it, then you can definitely do it. And also it's hard to express at the time, there were just so many gigs on. There are so many venues across London and club nights that they needed to fill the bills. It's kind of surreal to think there were like three, four, five band bills, 5, 6 days a week. So if you kept going round to these venues, bigging yourself up, eventually you're going to get a first on. So I think eventually the Baby Shambles one, I think Paddington's might have even been playing that gig at Rhythm Factory. It's one of those ones where...
It went to like 3 a.m. or something.
Yeah,
like
I think I think they never knew when Pete was going to turn up at the time. So they booked a bill that could last all night. And then when Baby Shambles turned up, that's when they could play. Yeah. So I think it was actually quite clever thinking of those, of like, if we have a 9-band bill, then we can just keep putting bands on and selling drinks. And then when Baby Shambles eventually get here at like 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and they're finally ready to play, we can have them on. And I remember, what was the Libertines one at the time that there was a bootleg of Piss Me Off? When Peter Perrett came on and they did The Only Ones, Another Planet. Like it was a time at the Rhythm Factory, various other venues where...
Was it not at the Rhythm Factory though?
That was at the Rhythm Factory, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a time when it was that, like, it was all between... Baby Shambles had started, but Libertines were kind of on-off.
He had Peter Perrett Jr. in his band for a little bit, didn't he?
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah.
I think so, yeah. And then the girl Gemma was drumming and I can't remember who played bass. But yeah, I'm pretty sure he was in.
Yeah, it was like the early incarnations of Baby Shambles when actually maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
They sounded, it was one of like, when they did those early songs with Paul Epworth, it actually sounded really good and tight and stuff and different to Libertines. But I think then through those gigs, probably around when, like Tom did, met Dominic Masters from The Others. And he was just a kind of very charismatic character who, as I'm sure he said on his, just gave everyone his phone number and was like, you know, call me if you need anything. So I remember like being at school the day after An Others gig at like first break, 11 a.m. And I was like, should I just call Dominic Masters and see what happens? It's really like bizarre. Oh, man,
I
like,
wish we had a recording of that phone
17 and he saved everyone's numbers in his phone to his credit, and I'd call up and be like, and he picked up and he's like, oh hey. And I was like, hey, is that Dom? And he's like, yeah, who's that? And I was like, Fred, you gave me your number. He's like, oh, all right, how are you doing? And I was like, I don't think I even realized at the time how ridiculous it was. Like, the few times I've been in bands over the years where we've had some fans, it's just not the done thing to give someone your number, let alone anyone your number. But to be fair to him, it's like he wasn't doing it for any inappropriate reasons or anything. It wasn't, finding Neverland or leaving whatever.
The indie version.
Finding a Whitechapel after party with a, like, he built a genuine community of people around and a bizarre mix of people. You know, someone like Texas Bob, this like aging psychedelic American guitarist, people like the Paddingtons from Hull, obviously Hope of the States, and everyone, you were either in a band or you wanted to identify as part of something. So they obviously had 853, which was their fan base. And you had all these subdivisions of groups from the Libertines message board at the time. So you had like these people, the Ilford Seven, who were seven kids who once got denied from An Others gig because they didn't have ID to get in. Or what were those other like Northern ones called? Violence at Bus Stops, remember? And it's like either all the boys were in a band and in a very sexist way, all the girls were like DJs or said they were DJs. And it was like, you know, 3 a.m. with a real mix of people. And, you know, the irony wasn't lost at the time on me at the time that The Others, I was singing along to a song called like This Is For The Poor every night, coming from a very like middle class background. But, you know, like, yeah, this is what it's all about. This is, but it was just a kind of, yeah, I don't want to get too misty eyed about it. I don't think it was any, that it was like any particularly better time, but it was just good because it was kind of amateur hour. Every city had their indie club nights. And if you were keen enough, I don't think there was any band across the country who couldn't get a gig. You know what I mean? Eventually, if you kept trying, there were gigs to play. Now there's just not enough gigs on probably to get from, you know, the rehearsal room. Also at the time in London, you could get very cheap rehearsal time right in central London, Enterprise Studio. I think it was called like 30 quid, 6-7 hours. There were six of us in the band, so everyone bought a fiver. And you could just stay there all day pretending you're in a band, you know, rehearse for half an hour of it. And there are all these venues right in the center, a lot of which are gone now, like the Astoria, beneath that, the Mean Fiddler, Metro Club around the corner, White Heat, which was originally at this club Infinity, where there was Culls Night, Dirty Pretty Things. And I remember getting a gig there, being like, we're going to meet Carl Barat, like 2 weeks, getting excited. Obviously, turn up and he's not there and absolutely nothing to do with it. But I think we got excited to meet his girlfriend. And Dean Fragile, who's still around, yeah, managing the Libertines hotels. You get him on. And he just got a Donnie Darko tattoo at the time. And he's like, what do you think of my tattoo? And I was like, oh my God, Donnie Darko, that's sick. simpler times. But around the same time, it was funny. It was like, I think GCSE time or AS level time at our school, we had to do work experience. And my brother had worked at the Oxfam around the corner. And I was like, I don't want to do that. And I said to my mum, I want to do something in music. And she was like, oh, well, there was someone I knew growing up who lived next door, who was a really good friend in the like late 60s, early 70s. And I think he's really successful in music now. and his name's Sean McCluskey. So Tom, you might remember him.
Yeah, I do remember him, yeah.
I described him in an article I wrote for The Guardian about indie as the Jabba the Hutt of the indie scene at the time, which he didn't seem to mind, so I'll say it again. So basically, she manages to track him down and get his phone number. She hasn't seen him in about 30 years, and I think, you know, whatever she'd understood as very successful in music was a slightly different story. So I'd kind of met him age 16, 17 in the early days of Les Inc. And he was like, oh, come to my night on the Rocks on Kingsland Road, which I think he did every Thursday. And he was like a proper, or at least it felt like, underworld character, running all sorts of like semi-legal club nights and warehouse parties in Whitechapel with like Death From Above 1979 or like that. Quite good bands, maybe Block Party. I think he was managing Towers of London at the time in their early incarnation. And he shared an office with James Milord, who was managing Pete Doherty. And I remember having been in there for like 2 days of this quote unquote work experience, which I don't know what the work was or what the experience was, but Max Carlish, that guy who made the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary, turned up at the office with a samurai sword in a black plastic bag, like threatening James Milord over something, and always dodgy stuff going on. And then I think like Block Party or someone, the Rakes had all their equipment stolen, and they said that Towers of London had nicked the equipment, and it was all kind of like a funny pantomime. But then obviously it bordered on quite serious stuff with like drug dealers and people needing paying. And at the time, you know, for me, what was the height of like as good as it got was finding out about Pete Doherty gig in his flat, which would be advertised on libertines.org, and they'd be like tenors on the door, which later got upgraded to 20s on the door, all these like, you know, 15 to 18 year old kids turning up at a block in Whitechapel paying £20 cash to get in a front room where you'd like wait for 2 hours, you know, drinking whatever you brought with you. And I don't think I drank at the time, so I was like bringing Tesco meal deals in there to like finish a chicken and bacon sandwich while you wait for the doctor. And not realizing at the time I was that all these like 20 quids were just paying off his drug debts. I don't even know if he would live in some of these flats. It was like, oh, he owed someone a grand or whatever, but knew if he could get 50 kids into a room and charge them 20 quid and play some songs on the acoustic guitar, he could pay it off. I mean, maybe, is that fair to say, Tom, what was going on?
I mean, yeah, it probably is quite accurate, that, to be honest. Who knows?
It was also at the time, like, my mum was being like, you know, at home, it was like revising for GCSEs or AS levels. And I remember a time when Baby Shambles played at the Troubadour in Earls Court. So it was around the corner from where I lived. And I think it was like the night either after I finished my GCSEs or AS levels. So I was like, okay, I'm going to celebrate by going to watch Baby Shambles. And I went, and during it, Pete Doherty smashed his guitar like halfway through the first song and walked out. And so the gig was over in one song. And I think I was either there by myself or with a mate, and I just like went home with my tail between my legs. And my mum was like, are you all right? And I was like, no, Pete smashed his guitar during the first song and Baby Shambles didn't play anymore. And she's like, did you get your money back? And I was like, no, they didn't offer discounts, didn't offer refunds. My mum's like, right, we're going around there now to get the refund.
No so way.
Like, surreal time of like being slightly involved in this world, but still being at the age where my mum would make sure I was getting a refund if the gig, you know, quite like simultaneously mollycoddled and in this bizarre world. So then my mum walked around and we managed to get the money back because she shouted at the manager being like, you can't charge them for one song. He smashed his guitar and walked off. But anyway, this is more talking about being a fan and stuff. But that's just to give a background that I think for a lot of bands, and I'm sure your Mystery Jets would say the same in some of the early days, like, because I remember seeing them around, like the Others gig on the Tube and stuff like that, or other bands. Being a fan kind of bordered on being in a band. It was almost like being in a band was an extension of the fan process. And I remember like eventually getting a gig with the others, and Paddington's actually at Cargo, I think, the day John Peel died. Do you remember that, Tom?
I remember playing Cargo, yeah, but was it the day that John Peel died? I never knew that.
Yeah, I only remember because, yeah, someone told us just before we went on stage. It was also, again, one of those things. You get a support slot with a band like the others or Paddington's or whoever at the time, or Baby Shambles. You think your life's going to change. You think the next day you're going to wake up and you're going to be everyone's best mate and your career will have gone sky high and you'll be on the cover of NME. I was like, this will be great, you know. Dom and Paddington's, they'll finally get to see us play and see we're quite good. And obviously you play at like 8 p.m. to 12 people in the venue. The bands don't turn up till quarter an hour before they're on stage. Obviously don't see your gig, probably forget you're playing, and it has no impact on anything. But at the time, support slots were a currency like worth their weight in gold. And Baron, to give some context, at the time we were finishing our set with a song called Chris Akabusi, where the chorus was Chris Akabusi, Cheryl Baker, Roy Castle, Record Breakers.
Oh my God, I fucking really forgot about that song.
Which gives you an insight into kind of where we were at on the kind of cultural ladder. But, you know.
Is that on, can we listen to that?
Unfortunately, there's some live recordings of it, but we were so self-important that at the time, like, we decided that the song was getting too popular, so we had to retire it from our set. So we did like 4 days of gigs in London that we called the All Roads Lead to Akabusi Tour, where we promised to retire the song after 4 nights. I think ending at that venue, the Pleasure Unit on Bethnal Green Road, where we're like, this is going to be the final performance of Chris Akabusi. I think we later played it our last two gigs, but there was never a proper recording, only live recordings.
So you releasing singles in this time as well, is that right?
Yeah, so our whole career basically consisted of two double-sided singles that were on the White Heat record label. So White Heat was the indie club night on Tuesdays, which, again, what was good about those times is it was before you needed proper ID to get in places. Anyone could turn up, you scan or photocopy in your passport and just change the one of the numbers. So, you know, we were going to clubs pretending we were 10 years old.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and the bouncers didn't give a shit. I think it wasn't until like David Cameron came in or later they changed some of the rules and it was like challenge 25 and you had to have a proper passport or driver's license. But this time it was literally kids in these clubs and they didn't ID at the bar either. So we were probably playing there from like 17. And Matty, who ran it, again, it would be great to get on the podcast because he was like probably had everyone play at White Heat over the years. He was starting a label at the time and he was the first person to be like, oh, you should record some of these, you know, record a single. We hadn't even recorded a demo. When we went to record our first single, it was the first thing we ever recorded. And we met this producer, Ian Gore, who I think had engineered on the Baby Shambles recordings, or maybe a Libertines album at Metropolis at the time. So I think he saw us at the gig where we were supporting Baby Shambles and said, oh, I can get you studio time at Metropolis. You know, we hadn't been to any studios before, so we didn't realize then that Metropolis was like where Queen recorded and one of the most expensive studios in London. And at the time, he was probably only like 22 or 23 himself, making teas and working nights on the desk, but trying to be the big man at a gig, saying like, I'll get you free studio time, which, to be fair, I think he eventually did. And that was our first single, Reunion and Much Too Much. And that came out 2005, the year we were leaving school. I think that was 5. That was our first one. And the next one, which was our last one, and the one that only one people really know, which is called How It All Went Wrong, which came out in 2006. But Les Inc was one of those bands that, only for years after, everyone was like, talked about how much they loved it. But at the time, no one gave a shit. So it was like, I wish all the people who said they liked it 10 years later had liked it at the time, because then we might have been able to get a deal or whatever, or done a bit more. I mean, looking back, we still, you know, we still did way, probably did way more than we deserved. We probably only played like less than 50 gigs, but that song ended up having a bit of a life of its own, because we knew once we'd all left school and everyone was going their separate ways and stuff, we didn't have, probably didn't have a huge amount in common. We weren't best mates, and it was probably the time when indie was starting to wane in terms of like when
Scene was probably on that kind of community thing was on its way out by the like 2006. Like,
who was the guy, Oasis guy who did Pop Tones at the time? What's he called?
Oh, yeah, McGee.
Yeah, so I think once Alan McGee, he was quite clever to create culture around Libertines. Like, obviously, the bands were good, some of them, like the Paddingtons. Did he do another single, Unstrung? He just signed a load of stuff for singles, and it created like a wider cultural context around the Libertines, which was good. But then after that, all that stuff had happened, and I think probably after that, once Arctic Monkeys came out and just did it so much better than everyone else, it was kind of like, I didn't realize at the time, but looking back, you can just see that Alex Turner was on another level from.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So, we broke up. We kind of broke up. The single out went wrong. We kind of knew the band was going to be over, and this weird thing happened that we had been on a tour with Vincent and the Villains. And the last night of the tour, Billy, who is in the band, ended up getting assaulted off on a night bus, getting into a. Someone kind of basically hit him and knocked him over. He ended up in a coma. The other guy in the band, and we'd already decided on the tour that we were probably gonna break up, but then that happened. And then by the time he came out of the coma, it was really like bizarre, like a film. We were basically okay, like now we're gonna play our last gigs. And one of our last gigs at the 100 Club was like the first gig we ever sold out. And that single had come and people liked it, but I think it was, I don't think there'd be any regrets about it, because we'd released our best song, and it's not like we're sitting on 20 amazing songs. So I think anytime record labels had shown interest, they probably heard the rest of our demos and were like, well, you know, they're not going to be, they probably don't necessarily have an album in them, but we definitely had a single in us, maybe not even two. But you know.
Did you have the same lineup as well all along? Did you always have that two frontmen thing?
Yeah, we had two frontmen because we both just really wanted to be in a band and neither of us could play anything. So, and then it kind of gave it, it's a bit of identity. Obviously, probably we were also ripping off the idea of like Pete and Carl or whatever, of like the romantic thing of two guys at the front or whatever. I mean, it's funny, like if you think about how much of the scene is associated with lads and like, quite blokey. It's funny how homoerotic so much of it all was. Like, you know.
Yeah, massively, yeah.
Like laddie guys from all over the country, like waiting hours to see like Carl and Pete's like lips brush up against each other and like look each other in the eye. And like, you know, guys with their tops off, like throwing beer, like squirting beer all over each other as this happened. Like, I think there was a lot of repressed, like, now we would call it toxic masculinity, that was then probably like taken out on people around, that of like men dealing with repressed stuff. And I think the Libertines and probably the Strokes, because of how they looked and stuff, gave some outlet for that or whatever. But it's quite bizarre looking back. And everyone, you know, the number of, I've just been back at my mum's house now, clearing stuff from my, like loads of stuff from my old room to repaint it and stuff, like all these, just any picture from the NME on the wall, the walls looked like it was wallpaper from the NME, pictures of bands I didn't even like, you know, like, or like that much, like Cooper Temple Claws or whatever, that I just like wanted all these like men with their like haircuts and clothes like on every surface of my wall. Quite like interesting. I think a kind of thing that wasn't analyzed at the time, but I know you had Connor McNicholas on, and that was that era of NME where it's like, I don't know if you remember the issue that came with free stickers. You know what I mean? It was like Just 17 or like a teen mag with like as much gossip as music. And I remember just thinking like, oh, that's the world. I remember reading an article that said Carl Barat was walking around with his belt undone. So I was like, okay, I'm not going to do up my belt. You know, it's probably borderline sexual harassment, but it was all like, oh, you know, Albert Hammond Jr.'s tie matched with his green tie matched to his green belt or whatever. And I'm like, oh my God, I need to get to Camden and find a green belt or something. You know what I mean? Just like funny, proper fanboying stuff.
And it's, I was reading that you ended up releasing a compilation of those songs. And on NME, it said you had an introduction by David Walliams on it or something.
Oh, yeah. So actually, that night that I talked about where we played the Dirty Pretty Things club night, we'd been just gutted that Carl Barat wasn't there. And someone was like, oh, his girlfriend's here. It's actually, and then we're like, oh, and then they were like, oh, wait, David Walliams is over there. And at the time, we were being managed by my cousin, who is now an actor. He ended up playing Donovan, the bully in The Inbetweeners. But he was our manager because he'd left school to become an actor. And he had a small part in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. But because his part wasn't that big, he basically spent most of his time in this trailer, his trailer for the film. So he was like, okay, I'm going to sort you gigs from this trailer. I'm going to call places and get you gigs. Which he did quite a good job on, to be fair, getting supports with like Pipettes or Neil's Children or, you know, like the mid-level indie bands at the time, 80s Matchbox, Black Wire. But I think he was there that night and he was like, okay, that's, oh my God, that's David Walliams. Let's get him to introduce you on stage. And at the time, because we hadn't made any proper recordings, we would record our gigs so we could try and use those recordings as demos to get more gigs or to kind of hear our songs back and try and work it out, because we could never remember the structures or like didn't know anything about song structures. We didn't have like verse chorus down pat. It was kind of like people doing the part they could remember whenever they thought of it. Anyway, David Walliams said, yeah, I'll introduce you, but you've got to write down what you want me to say. So we wrote down this like stupid thing for him to say. And he came on stage and he said it. And then at the end of the piece of paper, he was like, ladies and gentlemen, six young gay guys that I just know you're going to love, Les Incompetents, which we were all pissing ourselves at the time. And we had this recording. So we like, okay, we're putting together the CD, but we only had four properly recorded songs. We were trying to make an album's worth of material. So we were like piecing it together from live recordings and XFM sessions and stuff like that. And so we put that intro on the CD and then kind of released it and sold however many copies, probably only a few hundred. And then my cousin was going in for some acting thing like 3 months later or meeting an agent or something. And this was probably a year after we'd broken up, but the CD was still out. And that was the time where people kind of were getting into the band more, even after we'd broken up. And he was having a meeting about something. And then the lady's having the meeting was like, oh, and by the way, there's something else I need to talk to you about. And brought the Les Inc. CD out and like slapped it on the desk and was like, what's all this about? David Walliams' introduction. You had no right to do this. You didn't ask for permission. End up giving a cease and desist from the lawyer. So there are two versions of the CD. If you're one of the, you know, Venn diagram of 22 Grand Pod listeners who also has the Les Inc. CD, which I imagine is probably a large percentage, check if you've got the original version has the David Walliams intro, and the one we had to release after doesn't have the intro on. So that's a little bit of rare indie ephemera.
Can you listen to that anyway? I've noticed it's not on Spotify or anything.
No, it's only that one track was on Spotify, because during lockdown, like everyone was kind of, you know, when you're clearing out your shed or whatever, I was like, oh, people kept asking why the song wasn't on Spotify or why our singles weren't on. And I started asking around to see if anyone in the band or Matty, who we'd released with through White Heat, had the masters of our recordings. And basically it became clear that no one knew where the masters were or had them. So I was like, oh, we're not going to be able to, the music's like gone forever. And I think I tweeted asking if anyone had a copy of the CD, and my friends who run a really good record shop on Columbia Road called World of Echo, which is kind of like really hipstery music. He DM'd me and was like, don't tell anyone, but I've got a copy of that CD. So I went to borrow the CD off him and ripped the CD to get the single on Spotify. But we'll probably put the other tracks up eventually. They're just kind of...
Can we not play at the end of this interview?
Yeah, I could probably send you the Williams bit. It's not like he's going
to
mind.
Okay, we've just got a little friend come up to say a few words. Yeah, I hope you enjoy it.
I'm not a friend. I've never met them before.
Bullshit. We go way back.
He wrote these things down.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
And he also directed me and told me how to read them out. So if it's not funny, he's to blame, not me. Anyway. So here we are. Here's the introduction to the band. Anthea Turner once said, one should judge a gig by the quality of the songs and not the quality of the people. Am I doing it all right?
Yeah.
Okay. The quantity of people. Sorry. Oh, yes, sorry, yeah. And if that's the case, then let's look past these broom-covered walls and rock like they never took the Chuckle Brothers off the air. Ladies and gentlemen, six young gay guys that I know you're gonna love, Les Incompetents! Woo!
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod.
It's the only like versions of our music exist is like a ripping of the CD that came out or whatever.
Okay. What about the Chris?
I don't even know.
See one.
That might be just lost in the sands of time. Oh, and eventually there was, I think Chris Akabusi's daughter came to one of our gigs. There was something like that, and she'd heard about the song, so she came to do it. And she said she'd told him about the song. We were like, is there any way we could get him down to do a performance with us? And she was like, no, absolutely not. But it was funny. There were other things, like, do you remember that band Dustin's Bar Mitzvah?
Yeah, I love those guys.
Yeah, I remember we had a gig with them once, and it was us, and we were supporting them, and like no one had turned up, so they were like watching us and clearly not that into it, and then we were watching them, and they started taking the piss out of us on stage, and then either my cousin or Billy, the other singer, who were a bit more like up for fights at the time, were like, what the fuck, and like stepped up to the stage, and the guy Dave Laser, who I got to know about years later on, like threw his guitar down. They all jumped off the gig, jumped off the stage, and like it ended in like a Royal Rumble, and the gig was off. It was that kind of era. But it was funny after all that, I ended up doing, like, having watched MTV2 and been like, watched it every day. I ended up working with them like 2000 and 6, 7, 8 onwards, like, and then ended up meeting and interviewing lots of the kind of bands who I'd loved growing up. So that was interesting.
Yeah, Tom told me about that. And so how did that come about? Did someone like Zane Lowe reach out or something?
I don't think he knew, I think he'd played us a few times, but I don't think he knew about us. I think we'd managed to get an interview on at the Great Escape when they it was all used to be a bit more DIY, I think, and that Great Escape in Brighton, they were just, I think, interviewing any old people. And the producer, I think, of Gonzo, this guy Alex Hoffman, who I still know now well, who now is the head of content at Arsenal TV, so he's gone on a real journey from the brown.
Not the fan couch. TV.
Not the fan TV, no. from the brown couch to the red couch. But they'd interviewed us, and I remember being like, wow, this is our first TV interview. We're making Same to Say Any Old Shit. And I think I'd said something about, like, really out there to the presenter about, like, Zane Lowe throwing a baby off the pier in Brighton, or like just like saying any old shit to try and like draw attention. And they were, and all the guys filming it were pissing themselves, and one of them was him, and we kind of stayed in touch after that. And it was funny, the guy who was doing the interview was Toby, who ended up running Transgressive Records. Again, they'd be good guys to get on because they released all sorts of bands at that time, Mystery Jets, Larrikin Love. Actually, that's another thing, just to digress for a second. It was another thing that destroyed us is when Larrikin Love came out, because the first time I saw them, I was just like, fuck, that's kind of what we've been trying to do. But they were like tighter, better looking. There was only four of them instead of six of them. And they just really had the sound that was like kind of ska, almost a bit like gypsy folk, Dexy's Midnight Runners, that we'd kind of been trying to do but hadn't managed, and they just did it so much better. So I'd stayed in touch with him, and then after Les Inc, I was doing another band called Ox Eagle Lion Man, a bit more like proggy stuff that no one really liked. And he'd got in touch saying like, oh, would you be up for trying doing some out of studio roving reporting? Basically, I think because Zane Lowe was getting bigger by then and was more of a name, he didn't want to go to like Oxygen Festival in Ireland and like go to the campsite and interview the fans or whatever. So I was like, yeah, I'd definitely be up for that. But there's no like, there was no training or anything. You don't go to like learn how to do TV. So I think we had a couple of meetings, and then I was like with them going to Ireland. And I think on the first day I interviewed like Kings of Leon and Interpol. And Jesus. It was surreal, because like 2 years before, I'd literally been standing outside stage doors waiting for them to come out. Like when we couldn't get tickets to gigs, me and the other guys in our band would just be like, okay, Interpol are on at Shepherd's Bush tonight, so we'll just go there about 11 and stand outside until they come out. And at the time, you know, it always seems like the best idea in the world. And then by the time they come out the stage door at like 12:30, you don't even know what it is you want to say to them. Then they're like standing there and you're like, all right. And they're like, all right. And you're almost like too nervous to say, oh, can we have a photo or whatever? So you have to wait for them to be like, do you want a photo? And you're like, yeah, yeah. And I remember Chris, who was in Les Inc and later Spectre, the guitarist, once got Interpol to sign his GCS, his A-level art coursework, because it's all he had on him. they're like, can we get your autograph? Because again, pre-selfies, autographs were still a big thing.
Yeah.
Which shows, makes us sound fucking old. But like, I remember he got them to sign his art A-level coursework, and then was really worried about giving in the coursework. If he didn't get it back, he'd lose his Interpol signatures. So he had to like photocopy his art coursework and then Tippex out their signatures and then photocopy it again, and gave in the photocopy so that he could keep the original with the Interpol autograph on. But it's weird. It's funny looking back and being like such a fan, because even then doing these interviews for MTV2, which later became MTV Rocks. It was like, I was still a fan. I remember having to go to the toilet after interviewing Kings of Leon, almost kind of like hyperventilating and being like, oh, what the fuck? And it was, it was funny. I guess it was also still in the early days of the internet. Obviously, we'd met lots of people, new people from stuff like Libertine's message boards. And I remember even downloading the Arctic Monkeys demos from a message board when there was someone on the Libertine's message board called the Sheriff of Sheffield. Remember that, Tom?
I don't remember him.
No, he was the person who put up the Arctic Monkeys demos. And people always say, like, apocryphally, that Arctic Monkeys came out of MySpace, but it's not true. They were before MySpace. Lily Allen was the first big MySpace act. Arctic Monkeys, the demos were people downloading them off.
Yeah, they literally got, they were like kind of massive before they'd even put anything out on it.
Yeah, they were the first internet band, and it wasn't even like Napster. It's people putting up the links to the demos on like Libertine's message boards. And I remember like I met my friend Sahil, who's now still a really good friend, works in music. He was on the Rakes message board, and it was, and at the time I was like, oh, you're on the Libertines message board. He's like, no, I'm more on the, you know, Rakes and Block Party message board. And it was like, even like what message board you're on was part of your identity at the time. So, and even with MTV2, these kind of like funny broadcasts of interviewing bands were still, you know, YouTube only started in 2006, so this was before people could even watch stuff on YouTube. So I used to remember when I was at school, I would leave like the VCR at home to record 3 hours of MTV2 during the day, so then I could fast forward to watch videos I liked, because there was no other ways of watching videos. And I remember often, like, it was that thing called Video Plus. I don't know, where you had these codes that you typed in on the video.
I used to use that, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember like my dad getting annoyed because I'd like fucked up. He was trying to record Brookside or whatever, and I'd ended up getting 3 hours of MTV2 on there instead. But like, it's hard to express, again, without wanting to sound like a granddad, how much harder and like weirder this stuff was. To even watch a music video, having to like VHS the TV and hope that that one happened to happen while you were recording it. And so bands, again, like in some ways seemed a bit more out of reach, and kind of, especially the American ones like Interpol, Kings of Leon, Yeahs, whatever, Strokes, which made it all the more exciting when you had bands like Libertines or the others, or even probably when I first met the Paddingtons. I remember Josh had a jacket that he'd written a Clash lyric on the back, like, I'm so bored of the USA.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
And I remember at the time thinking like, wow, that's so cool. Josh had probably never even been to America, I'm guessing, at the time.
Yeah, you're probably right, actually. Probably not at that point. That was like really early on, wasn't it?
Yeah, and just stuff like that. I was like, wow, he's written on the back of his leather jacket. And I remember like making my own t-shirt. Sorry, I've gone backwards now from the MTV stuff, but I've gone back into fan world of like making a t-shirt. You can edit this out later, edit out the boring bits. There was like XFM, I remember, put on Wayne's World 1 and Wayne's World 2. And I made a t-shirt. I was like, I didn't want to... I'd seen that there were Rough Trade t-shirts and didn't have a Rough Trade t-shirt. So I got a Rough Trade plastic bag, cut out the bit that said Rough Trade and like safety pinned it onto the t-shirt. Like, it was that kind of like sad, but in a way like cool. Like,
you probably thought you were being really different as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but so yeah, it's funny that, yeah, so it was like being a fan, being an artist, and then that segued in into interviewing these bands, but still kind of being a fan. And then
did you find those bands, some of them, my reputations have been quite hard to interview, like, how did you find it?
Yeah, some people could. It was kind of like the ones that I often knew most about and was most excited to interview were the hardest to get anything out of. And then I'd interview someone like Ian Brown, but I probably like listened to a bit of Stone Roses, but definitely never listened to any of his solo stuff. and it would just be the most insane interview. He would, would tell me about his like trip to Israel and what the chief rabbi had told, the discussion he'd had with the chief rabbi, and all like, you know, crazy shit. Or Jay Spaceman from Spiritualized, probably looking back, the people who are on the most or the best drugs, and they would just be able to go off on a completely different tangent, you know. But then you might meet an American band who you'd be really excited about later on, stuff like MGMT or whatever, and it would be, yeah, the conversation would be slightly more stunted. And then I remember I was probably a bit less like friendly and up for it than Zane Lowe was, even though I was 19, 20, I was probably just being a bit of a dickhead, like everyone is at that age, maybe slightly more so. And like, I remember interviewing the Kooks and being a bit harsh, and they're like, we can't use that or whatever.
Being a bit harsh, what do you mean?
I think he said something like, they would written their second album, and he'd said he'd demoed 100 songs for it. And I said something, I said something like, what, and these were the best 10 or something like that. I don't think I meant much, but it came out in a bad way.
Yeah, of course you didn't.
Yeah, again, it's when you're that age and you're kind of, first you're on stage and you're like, there's, you know, something surreal about being on stage, because suddenly you've got a microphone plugged into a PA and you're the loudest voice in the room. And you're like, okay, now I can really say some shit. And again, once you've then got a TV camera pointing in your face, and I knew, you know, this wasn't exactly primetime BBC One. It was like, it was probably as close to a bit of a Wayne's World vibe as you're going to get in UK TV at the time. And I think by the end of MTV Two, when it became MTV Rocks or something, once YouTube came out, they said it was only a few thousand people watching at a time. You know, it went, all the MTV channels went from really big thing to kind of quite a small thing. And this was probably at the time that was happening. But I remember like, weird bit, I was trying to look what's on YouTube, because I think most of this doesn't make it to YouTube. I've got DVDs somewhere, but it was just trying to make something out of nothing. So like, there's one I saw on YouTube where it's like, we had an MTV jacket and we're trying to make some content to like, as a give it away. And I was like, okay, let's find these like four pissed guys and we'll say who can climb to the top of this tree the quickest, and we'll film them. We say you get to the top of the tree and you win the jacket. It was kind of like going out and finding, especially Oxygen Festival. I don't know if it's still on, but like that was in Ireland, and often the Irish festivals and the Scottish festivals, Tea in the Park was the same. They just went for it a little more. I used to go to Reading as a teenager, but I remember the first time I saw Leeds Festival and I was like, ah, yeah, this is a bit more of that. By comparison, Reading feels a bit like, you know, tea time in the park, not tea in the park. Leeds was like, you know, people throwing mobile phones into fires to watch them explode and stuff. It was hard and it was weird. It was some of it was easier than I thought, and some of it was harder than I thought. But I definitely realized ultimately, I was like, I think I started on MTV the same week that Laura Whitmore started. So that was one of her first gigs. And I remember she was doing the main MTV at the time, and I was doing MTV too. And, you know, TV, like anything, you've got to really want to do it and be good at it to end up, you know, making it. I think the stuff that we were making was never destined for the big league. It was kind of like trash in a good way.
Was it something you wanted to carry on then, or you knew you wanted to do music really?
Not really. It's actually probably watching those bands. Like, I remember, I think we did one of the festivals, I don't know, maybe it was Benicassim, the year Blur reformed, one of the summers that I think when Blur reformed, I don't know if it's 2008, 2009, and like something, watching some of these bands, or watching your dog Interpol's and Kings of Leon at that point in their career, where I love the second Kings of Leon album, but once they got to, they ended up, it's funny, you know, about Kings of Leon and Killers ended up being way bigger than the bands that came first. And it talks a bit about that in that book, Meet Me in the Bathroom. But I Googled even the other day for something that, like, Arctic Monkeys sold 20 million albums and the Strokes have sold 4 million. So though, you know, the Strokes are still this, like, the biggest cultural thing for people in our generation, they didn't end up actually being commercially very big. No. They didn't.
But I kind of think that's why I still love them a bit as well. Like,
they never did a Sex on Fire.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly that, yeah. It's like Kings of Leon went a little bit too far with it, with some of it. And yeah, don't get me wrong, I love some of the Kings of Leon stuff, but some of it's dreadful as well, I think.
But yeah, and then the years, so then after the years where this kind of the 22 gram pod era stopped, so probably like after Klaxons and stuff, then while I was on MTV, to that's when you had like Vampire Weekend and MGMT coming out, bands like that, and there was that wave of American stuff that was kind of, and just seeing these bands on stage, or even people that I'd knew lots when I was young, like Florence and the Machine, or people I'd met, Mumford & Sons or whatever, who ended up going on to do really well. I think I was probably just quite jealous at the time of, like, fuck, these people have actually made commercial careers. Laura Marling, you know, Jamie T, people we'd met playing, there was this all ages club called Way Out West in the old Brentford football corner of the bar of the Brentford, old Brentford Stadium, where they just had this all ages gig, I think either once a month on a Friday. And my friends who were a band called Fear of Flying at the time, who became White Lies, were like, you've got to play this all ages gig. So Les Inc would play there, and that's where we'd meet like Jamie T, Laura Marling, Good Shoes. So it was more kind of West London, dare I say it, Thames Beat bands, American Love. But feeding into that, seeing then the bands like that that went on to do really well, Laura Marling, Jamie T and stuff. I was like, fuck, these people have actually made commercial careers doing that. And I'm kind of, even though at the time, obviously, getting to interview people for MTV2 was still an amazing, like, privilege, I was still probably jealous of the bands on stage and seeing them doing that. That's when I was like, oh, actually, I want to still try and kind of do a band that can go a bit further than a couple of singles or whatever, which led to what eventually became Spectre, I guess.
Spectre then, obviously your third band at that point. What was your mindset going into that? Was it like, right, I know what I need to do now to make it more, I guess, commercially successful or more viable? Or were you just thinking, you just wanted to enjoy music at that point?
No, it was definitely more the former, probably. Like, there were lots of bands. You know, it's a competitive, often a competitive and like toxic environment, music, like probably many things. And I was less mature and probably was, a lot of it was just came down to jealousy of bands who'd got more successful, got record deals and got on in the NME and stuff. Like, I remember Les Inc had supported the Horrors on their second gig, and they end up being on the cover of NME like 3 months later. That must have been 2006 or something. And so coming into 2009, 2010, I'd done this band, Oxygo Lion Man, with Sean and Tommy, who'd both been in Les Inc. And we'd released two EPs on Transgressive and a first single, which we'd actually done with Gordon Raphael, who did the Strokes album.
Ah, so cool.
A kind of whole of my growing up, from teens into early 20s, was just like interlaced with all this. Indie was the kind of backbone of it, even though it wasn't probably the music I listened to the most, or at least the bands that came out that I liked the most were like the slightly weirder ones, like British Sea Power or Liars, and you know, the slightly more left of center ones. But so we'd been making this quite out there music, obviously making no money, all doing other things to support it, and that kind of reached the end of it, the line, I was like, well, I either never do music, I either realize or kind of come to terms with the fact that music's not for me, which is probably, you know, sliding doors maybe would have been a more sensible decision, or to try and have one more shot at doing it, quote unquote, like properly. But in my mind, that meant a record deal, because I'd seen these bands who got record deals and thought, this is, you know, this is the goal in a way, which is probably a bit is a confused way of looking at it. And on the off chance there's any young people listening to this who are in music, and I've worked with young artists now, I always try and get this across to them, that, you know, a record deal is not the be all and end all. It will not make your career, unless you've got something going on anyway. Unless you know who you are, then a record deal's not gonna, it will help join quite a lot of dots, but it's not gonna make you a better artist. It's just gonna kind of raise the stakes. But nonetheless, not knowing any of this, I just kind of set out to be like, okay, well, how do we make a band that could be big? Like, what would those songs sound like? Like, more emotional, simpler, bigger, kind of. I tried to find all the most good-looking people I knew rather than the best musicians I knew, which, again, I don't regret, because I've made some of my best friends in the world over it. But just the process of making it is funny, because it was just very cynical. And having had those things growing up of like, it was just the guys who were hanging around and then we met up and we made these tunes, it was more like, no, I'm gonna sit at home trying to crack the code, you know, of pop songs, get down to three chords, memorable, repeated lyrics. So like, one of the first songs that we managed to do where that worked, this song Never Fade Away, where it's, you know, literally one lyric is probably repeated, I don't know, 14 times on the song over three chords, and to this day when we play is still one of our best songs, you know what I mean? And there's a quote from Rivers Cuomo that I always quote about songwriting, where he's like, songwriting's a lot easier than you think it is, that's what makes it so hard. And that was kind of, it's hard to get into that space where you don't think and you just feel, but somehow through the kind of the yearning for wanting to make kind of commercial indie pop songs mixed with this like pure unadulterated jealousy for all of my friends and contemporaries who had careers in music, somehow we kind of managed to conjure these songs out of something thin air. And we had a few kind of lineups. Originally the band was called Club Royale. We had different names. It was Spectre, spelt the other way, RE, as in like a ghost. But then we couldn't use that for some reason, so changed the spelling like that. But again, think of, you know, like the fortuitous indie people from in the past. We got this song Never Fade Away recorded, and we didn't have anyone to put it out because there wasn't as many 7-inch labels as there had been back in the day, where you could end up doing a 7-inch, you know, club nights had 7-inch labels and everyone was releasing 7-inches. And I ended up meeting, or through our bass player, we ended up meeting Mairead from Queens of Noise, who by that time had started her own label, Love, Love, Love. And again, it was one of those things that Queens of Noise was used to be a night that I would queue up outside. I remember once going to see Baby Shambles there, queuing up to get in from early, getting in there and then seeing the band who were on before the club night started, which was Test Icicles, which featured Dev, who became Blood Orange. And I remember meeting him, our first conversation was, I said, how did you get your jeans so tight? Because this was before you could buy skinny jeans like commercially on the high street. This must be in 4 or 5 or something. And he was like, oh, what you do is you buy normal jeans, put them on inside out, and then put safety pins all the way down the outside so they're tight to your leg, and then reverse them, pull them inside out again so they're the right way around, but all the safety pins are on the inside. So the number of times I would go out with jeans like that, jumping up and down in the mosh pit, and then stab myself with a safety pin like right into my thigh from these tight jeans. But it was quite fortuitous that we met her again, who I hadn't seen for quite a few years, and she started this label and she heard Never Fade Away, and she's like, oh, I'll put out your single. And we managed to take it from there. And that was kind of like all the things that we'd never got to do as, and it was Chris who'd been in Les Inc, but hadn't been in Oxley, came back and was like, he wanted to do a band again. All the things that we hadn't been able to do as teenagers, and all our indie kind of dreams, we managed to compress into 1 year or a couple of years, where we managed to like tick off all the bucket list, but at such a kind of high rate, a quick rate, you almost couldn't like, you couldn't notice at the time. So almost like a, you can have, you know, be careful what you wish for, or you can have it all, but how much do you want it? To, you know, paraphrase one of the podcast faves. it was, again, that was like an amazing experience, but the opposite of these like 5, 6, 7 years spent in the indie wilderness, putting out 7 inches and EPs and playing gigs and hoping to support, you know, a band you liked. It was suddenly playing on Jules Holland or getting to go to Japan or playing Reading, like ticking off all these things, or like ending up meeting or getting to know all these people that I'd had on my wall as a kind of teenager. Like even now, I don't know, someone like Bill Ryder Jones, who was in the Coral at the time, the Coral, one of my favorite bands growing up, and then getting to know him and working with him on music for us, and or like Carl Barat, whatever, ended up working on some music with him more recently. Just like a funny turn of events where, this will sound very pretentious, but like you know, sometimes feel like time isn't linear, just moving, you experience time from beginning to end through life, but sometimes I think things come from the future backwards, and often so many of these things have like coalesced, I don't know if that's the right word, but like people or things from the past, even getting to know Tom Pad again in completely different circumstances, where you then meet as adults, and it's almost like a kind of weird extended family, and then you're trying to like piece together the past of like, wait a second, how did this happen from this or whatever. So yeah, we were very lucky that it was a kind of third time lucky with getting to do a band that at least quite briefly was a tiny bit commercially successful enough to kind of put out a couple of records on a major label. And now we still tour and still release. We've got an album coming out in October, and kind of through this whole process of somehow managed to make, you know, indie peace with the gods, that it's like finally age 34, stage age 33, I've got these, I exercised all these demons, all these like stings of characters and people and things. I mean, I don't even know if most of the music has been very good, but a lot of the time, you know, when there are very good artists who naturally will make brilliant, life-changing music by expressing themselves, and there's people, you know, like Alex Turner or Jarvis Cocker or the Gallaghers, or, you know, loads. But then also you get these kind of the other people who were there who just like were keen enough to want to do it. And I kind of see my life in indie almost as like Tom Hanks in what's it called? The running one.
Forrest Gump,
where you suddenly realize you're like a dude in the background of all these kind of great things happening. But it's also funny because, again, it's like, it's not the music I'd go to listen to when I'm by myself. And yet it's kind of it's one thread that I think, just from following as a fan to a kind of working in it to kind of making it. It's like, well, it's just one. It's probably the only thing I vaguely understand. So kind of you keep doing it, but for God knows why, in the vain hope that one day you'll, you know, accidentally write Wonderwall or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, talking to people on the podcast, like, sounds like quite a challenging era to like start a band, really. Like, if you've, obviously that's when you've had your most success, but do you think it maybe was more challenging during that period or not really?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the era that we came up in and Tom came up in, I don't think it's just about, obviously tastes change, but also I think that a lot of that era was about live music. There was a lot of live music. I could name 10 to 15 venues in London that have closed down in the last, since we were playing gigs back then, since the early to mid noughties, and very few that have opened up in their place. So I think you've obviously got festivals, but I think there's less of a culture for just bands playing club nights and stuff. Not to say that'd be that way forever, not to say that's necessarily even worse, but I think that was a kind of perfect storm of pre-internet, kind of the end of a certain bit of subculture. And that book, Meet Me in the Bathroom, about the New York scene, I think articulates a lot of that well. It's not to say you can't start a band now and have great success, and there are lots of great bands out there, but I don't think there's enough of an ecosystem through club nights, independent labels and blogs to maintain these micro scenes across the UK. You know, in America, it's big enough to that you can tour from one side to the other and then back again. And you can kind of just maintain from touring. But the UK, there's only so many tours you can do, you know, in a year or across 2 years before people are like, well, I'm not going to see you that many times, because there's not quite enough cities. And then there's the local scenes. I mean, I say that there's lots of great local scenes, and I know lots of bands from Glasgow right now, for example, that where they do have an ecosystem of that. But I think in terms of every town and city having an indie club or two or three, and the bands that play there and come out of those, I think is less right now, because I think people are finding bigger platforms more quickly on social media. You know, if you're gonna, you can go on TikTok and reach hundreds of thousands of people as a solo artist much quicker than trying to find a rehearsal space and two or three other people that play an instrument, work out who's going to play what, write a song. You know, by the time you've done all that, you can have a whole music career on social media. We've also got the means to record music at home easily. You know, now when we write songs using software, Ableton, Logic, whatever, it's readily available, cheap software that lots of people steal for free, and everyone can make music in that way now, which I think is a really good thing. I don't think, I'm glad those barriers to entry have gone and it's been democratized in a way. It's definitely less, there's definitely, you know, way more women feeling comfortable making music than probably would have felt comfortable playing on a lot of these very like male heavy, sweaty kind of Larry bills or whatever. So I don't think this is just a case of like in the past it was better. I think the way we consume and listen to music has changed a lot, and so the way I think we create it has changed with that. But that's not to say, if you're listening umming and ahhing about being a band, it's not to say to not do it. I still think the best bands in history are yet to come, but I don't think we need to compartmentalize music in the ways we used to when there was more culture around it to sell, like magazines and stuff. I think, you know, NME and Melody Maker and all these magazines came to an end, but so did X Factor come to an end. People get bored of everything eventually. it's not to say there's not going to be another pop star because X Factor ended, or there's not going to be another, you know, Blur or Pulp because NME closed. There's lots of great indie music in different forms now. You know, Sleaford Mods, Baxter Jury, or, you know, Fat White Family, that kind of world. I mean, I did just name three all-male lineups, but still, like, it's slightly different. Things happening in different forms, you know, older people or people not necessarily playing with a drummer, a bass player, a guitarist. And I think it's a little bit more fluid now in terms of how you can break through. I think we the noughties was maybe the last time where we still had this a bit of a hangover of like, oh well, it's we do it in the way we did with the 60s and 70s. You know, it was probably even then was a bit of a celebration of something retro. And the Strokes are amazing, but they were a retro band too, and so in a way everything they influenced was a bit retro. It's not like we're talking about a cutting edge sound like the dawning of dubstep or something and trying to analyze what threads came together. We're talking about 3 minute rock songs, which was a medium older than most of our parents, you know what I mean? It's kind of already a bit of a throwback. So I definitely don't want to get misty-eyed about like the third or fourth generation of it, even though obviously but I think it's definitely good to discuss it. And that's why I love listening to this podcast, because I feel like it's the first time that it's far enough away from now that we can begin to analyze it and try and understand it and be like, okay, well, what was that all about? Because clearly everyone was having a great time and lots of great music did come out and lots of terrible music, as is often the way.
Yeah, I always like to dip into NME.com and find some interesting stuff. So found a few stories. Apparently Stuart Pearce is a fan. Is that right?
Yeah, he actually came to see us when our second album came out, Moth Boys. I think it was in 2015. There's a photo of us.
Yeah, so
it was bizarre. It's like we didn't want to say like, why are you here? But we're trying to chat to him, and he was like, you know, I bought tickets. So I was, but he didn't necessarily look very happy to be there. maybe that was Psycho coming out. But yeah, that was a funny fan. I don't know if he's still into it. Stuart, if you're listening, new album out on cover first.
Give it a shout out on Talkspot, isn't it? And then you recorded with the Sugar Babes, is that right? Did some backing vocals or something?
Yeah, that was a really surreal day. I think I'd gone to New York, and this is testament to kind of like the last days of major labels spending money on stupid stuff, that they paid so I could go to New York to make some demos with Dev Blood Orange for our second album. And I think we'd made these demos, and then a few days later he was working with what was the original lineup of the Sugar Babes, who'd just got back together at that point and were called MKS. So it was Mutya, Keisha and Siobhan, the original three. And on the same day it happened, Chris, who'd been in the band on our first album, kept trying to say that he needed to Skype me. And so he eventually got me on Skype, and he was like, I'm leaving the band and I'm going to China to start my own band. And I was like, all right. He was the guy who I'd started the band with, and like we'd co-done a lot of it together. So I was like completely shocked in New York, where I didn't know many people, with the kind of forming member of the band having just left over Skype, because he was annoyed about something really, I don't know what it was. Just the kind of funny things when you're in a band where everyone gets really self-important. I mean, I'm sure me more than him, and you have these kind of very lofty conversations about a band that probably only has, you know, however many thousand fans. And I texted Dev being like, oh my God, Chris just Skyped me to say he's left the band. And he was like, oh, mate, well, I'm recording with the Sugar Babes. Why don't you come down and it might cheer you up. So I got the Metro. Is it called? Not the Metro, the subway, sorry. Along to this studio that he was in, like the 8th floor or something in Manhattan, and got there and like still down, and our guitarist just left the band, and there's like the original Sugar Babes lineup sitting on the sofa. And he was like, oh, we need a backing vocal that we think it would be sound good as a guy. Would you be up for doing it? End up doing it. I think the song's called Flatline, so you should check it out, because I did this kind of like, and actually weirdly it was a backing vocal that kind of sounded like something like The Enemy or The Rakes. So again, a little bit of indie being weaved, a little bit of Landfill touching the godlike teeth of Mutya's vocal. And they were all so nice. I think we were following each other on Instagram for a long time. They probably unfollowed me by now, given the boring content. But it ended up coming out, and the day ended, then we went to like, I don't know if we went to a bar or something with the Sugar Babes, but this day that had begun with a founding member of the band leaving ended with that. And I just
and then ended with you joining sort of Sugar Babes.
Exactly. And I was like, fuck Spectre. But then I think that song came out, didn't do too well, and it's taken, didn't do as well. So now it's taken until now for this, they've managed to get the name Sugar Babes back, because they had to be called MKS at that point, because I think the label owned the name Sugar Babes, and they've so years of court cases. They haven't put a song out since then. I think that was probably 2013, but now they've got the rights to Sugar Babes back. So fingers crossed they'll be coming out with some new stuff soon.
And then apparently, well, I saw it on Twitter, a guy's got a fairly big tattoo on his neck of your face.
Yeah, that is bizarre. Again, we did all right, but we never got that big as a band. Did all right, so I shouldn't complain, but it's like, I'm just trying to say this to give context to, like, we're definitely not the sort of band you get the lead singer's face tattooed to your neck, just in case anyone's listening and thinking, you know, in another country that we're like a big band. We're not. This guy, people often tweet, I don't know if you've heard this over the years, Tom, maybe it's like you're a bit more pre-social media with stuff, but like they say, oh, can you write out your lyrics because I want to get it tattooed or whatever. But I'm always a bit like, not sure. A, my handwriting shit, and B, I don't want to put someone through having, you know, a Spectre lyric tattoo. And I think this guy at the time was tweeted saying, I'm going to get a tattoo of your face. And I thought he was taking the piss. So I didn't think much of it, because had I known, I'd have probably, you know, offered him money not to do it. And then one morning, I just get this picture on Twitter. Is a photo of me looking, well, a tattoo of me looking really, a photo of a tattoo of me looking really smug. I think taken from a Roger Sargent photo shoot who'd done that original Libertines NME cover to bring it all back full circle. And my lips kind of look like I've got like, my lips are quite like pouty in this tattoo. And
I'll show you it, Tom. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me see that.
Yeah, I'll share a screen.
How have you never told me about this, Fred?
It's just not the kind of thing you would tell someone.
Is it working? There it is. Can you see that, Tom?
Oh, wow. Is that not Harry Potter?
That's probably what people think, but just for anyone at home, and we can maybe use this photo as the podcast picture, but for anyone at home listening, you know, it's not just the face, like neck, shoulders, background.
He's fucking
What makes me more embarrassed, even though the guy's clearly a legend, there's actually, Vice then did an interview with him, so if you Google it, I think the article's called something like, I got a tattoo of a pregnant person's face from Spectre or something. You can see all his other tattoos, and he's got some quite funny ones. But on the other side of his neck, he's got Alex Turner, which makes me feel extra embarrassed that, like, on one side of his neck, he's got, you know, the greatest songwriter of our time, and on the other side, he's probably got one of the most mid-level songwriters of our time. But I'm touched, and, you know, if push came to shove, I'd probably get a tattoo of his face to say thanks.
I saw you released, is it a couple of songs you've released this year, and Tom said he got plans to release more, is that right?
Yeah, so we've got a new album on October the 1st, Now or Whenever, and a few singles. There's actually one that comes out tomorrow, Bad Summer, so it'll probably be out by the time this comes out, and we're touring in the UK and Europe, so come. Yeah, our tours are usually quite fun, and again, every time we think, oh, maybe it's time to break up the band, we'll go on tour and it'll be really fun, and it'll be like, oh no, maybe we should stay together for one more thing. Like, the older you get, tours, when bands are kind of part-time, a tour's like kind of going on a weird stag do or something, like grown men getting together who don't hang out all the time to go to, you know, Hull and Glasgow and stuff. It doesn't, on paper, it doesn't make sense, but you know, it's better than just staying in watching Netflix. I mean, for the band, I can't speak for the audience. So yeah, we're going to be touring and yeah, releasing music. Mm. Check it out.
Is that what it's like though? Is it kind of like an ongoing assessment of where the band is, like, we'll do this next thing and see how that goes? Or do you have like longer term targets kind of thing?
Yeah, kind of. There are long-term targets, but then they all get lost in the short-term targets of life, especially when you're older and you're working out how you're earning money and how you do family and where you're living and all the kind of just the reality check of life. A band can't take as much priority. I think it only takes as much priority as people want to see it, unless there's demand for you all around the world. It's only like, you know, you tour to the UK every other year. But what's been good is, since not being, we were on Fiction for five years, which is a really good label, but then since then it's like it's just much easier to self distribute. So this is kind of a boring bit of shop talk, but it just means you can get your own music all over the world much easier. Like, you know, the three of us could record a song this afternoon and we could have it out on Spotify around the world by Friday. You know, when I first started releasing music, the reason you had to make 7 inches, I remember I first met Mark Vincent from Vincent and the Villains, again, who'd be good to get on the podcast. He was outside Rough Trade, where he parked his car to bring a box of 7 inches round that he was driving between record shops himself. That was what distribution looked like in 2003. It was, you know, unless you had a distributor, you were literally lugging boxes of records and sending CDs to XFM repeatedly, hoping that someone would listen to the CD and then decide to play it on the radio. Now, it's all just, that's one part of it that's got way easier. You can distribute, and if you have a bit of a fan base, you can, and you're not spending too much money recording, you can then own your own masters and get it out there in a way that's kind of, in some ways, made it, at least the business side of it, slightly more logical, because rather than borrowing hundreds of thousands of pounds you're never going to make back, you're earning, you know, a few grand here and there to then spend on recording for songs that you own the masters of, that you can distribute digitally for next to free, basically, all over the world, and then occasionally make vinyl or CD when you can afford it, kind of thing. So on that side of it, it's definitely the era of needing a record label to survive is gone, and some of the biggest and best artists now do it without record labels. So that's a kind of positive thing of being in a band for a while. But yeah, generally, yeah, it's on a kind of year by year basis, but we're lucky that although we don't have the biggest fan base, we've got some very dedicated fans who I think would be so personally upset if we stopped making music that we kind of do it just for them on the off chance they'll do something crazy like get another tattoo our faces.
Yeah, I suppose he could deface a tattoo if he wanted to, couldn't he?
Exactly. He should get, I don't know, he should get Alfie Templeman's face tattooed over it or something. I don't know, big indie person of today.
And then you always like to try and finish on a funny story. Like we usually say about the Gallagher brothers, but I mean, you have given us some great stories about back in the day, but I don't know if you had one that stood out.
I was trying to think about the Gallaghers. It's not a story per se. I'll end it with two sad stories.
Right. Okay.
Give an insight into the sadness that's at the heart of indie for the idiots like me and Tom who still try and keep some skin in the game. One was, this is the Gallagher one. We played on Jules Holland in 2011, Spectre, probably too early, but it's like, you know, when they come knocking, you're not going to turn it down. We played probably 5 gigs at the time, but had managed, someone had seen it, us support someone, and we'd managed to get on, which makes it sound, you know, I don't want to sound pithy about it, because, you know, when we found out we were going on, we literally were jumping up and down, screaming. It was a real lifetime aim to get on. But we end up being on the series finale, and it was all quite established acts, and we are probably definitely, you know, we'd been together a year or two, didn't rehearse that much, weren't the tightest band in the world, and kind of weren't exactly going to sound like, you know, Rage Against the Machine or whatever. And I think who was playing? It was a mad lineup. Bjork, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Michael Kiwanuka, and Noel Gallagher. And we played, you do the live bit on the Tuesday, and then you play the two other songs that get, well, one other song that gets played on the Friday. And afterwards, we were downstairs in the dressing rooms that were all kind of next to each other, getting photos with Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers, and going up to Bjork and chatting to her. She had like a 30-piece all-female, Icelandic choir with her, getting photos with them, and just like everyone being super nice and being like, wow, this is, being a musician's great. And then I remember seeing Noel Gallagher in the corridor, and I started to walk up to him as if to go like, hey mate, like, great gig, let's get a chat or whatever, I'll get a photo. And he just shook his head at me like, no, don't come any nearer. Wow. And I just pretended like I was walking past. He was probably shaking his head like, that was terrible. But, you know, you win some, you lose some. The other sad story, going back to being a fan, was that I remember when Pete Doherty and Wolfman single For Lovers came out, which I think ended up being like a top 10 or top 20, even top 5 like hit single. Testament to how different times were then. There was a signing at HMV, and I'd seen this book, The Libertine, that I think was what the film with Johnny Depp was based on, in a charity shop. And I was like, oh, I'm going to buy that book because it's called The Libertine. And then I remember thinking at the time, I was like, oh, I'm going to give this to Pete as a gift when I go to the signing at HMV, which again, just like mad. And probably queued up in HMV for an hour and a half while like all these people just told their life story to Pete. And got to the front, gave him this book, and he was like, oh, thanks, mate, like, blah, blah, blah. I've always wanted to read this or something. And I was like, oh, are you staying at the blah, blah hotel? I think I knew there was some hotel in Edgware Road or something that he was staying, and being like a weird stalker fan, I was like, oh, are you staying at this hotel? And he was like, I was like, it's where near where my parents live. And he was like, oh, really? He was like, you should come around for breakfast. And I was like, oh, really? Wow, yeah. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, great. And I was with my friend, and we were like, okay, great. Pete Doherty's invited us to breakfast at the hotel in Edgware Road. So we were like, okay, well, we'll need to get there early for breakfast. So we went back to stay at my parents' house where they lived, like West London. And we're like, okay, we'll stay the night and we'll set our alarms at 7. so we can get round there nice and early for breakfast with Doherty. Turned up at this hotel, you know, two 17 or 18 year olds, and probably something like something out of Home Alone 2. The person at the desk was like, yes. And they're like, oh, we're here to see Pete. And they're like, Pete who? And we're like, Pete Doherty, he's invited us for breakfast. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, we'll just call his room. So the person on the desk called his room. They're like, hello, like, you know, Mr. Doherty. So he's like, there's two boys here to see you for breakfast. And they're like, we kind of can't hear what's being said on the phone. They put the phone down. They said, he said, come back tomorrow. So we go home and we're like, and my parents are like, how did it go? Like, we're thinking it's a bit weird. I don't know if we told them actually, but again, I don't know what they must have thought was going on. And we're like, oh no, it's tomorrow. Breakfast is tomorrow. It wasn't actually today. We're going back tomorrow. So again, we sit around all day. It must have been school holidays or something. Set our alarms again for the next day, having done nothing except, you know, get excited about our breakfast tomorrow, the day after. Go back to the hotel at 8 a.m. and the person behind the desk gives us this sad look of like, and we're like, we're here for breakfast with Pete. And they're like, and the person at the desk is like, he checked out in the middle of the night. He's gone.
That's a great finishing point.